Kildare Today.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
Gardaí investigating an ongoing scam in which young people are coerced into paying blackmail money over explicit images have urged victims to report the crime immediately and not to delete any relevant evidence. In a number of separate cases in Meath over the past few weeks, teenagers were given demands for thousands of euros to stop explicit images of them from being shared online with friends and family. Professor James O'Higgins Norman is UNESCO Chair on Tackling Bullying in Schools and Cyberspace and Director of the National Anti-Bullying Centre at DCU. He also specialises in online safety. Professor Higgins O'Norman, good morning to you and welcome to the programme.
Good morning.
This, I suppose, is a very worrying scam that has been doing the rounds over the last while and just come into the public light recently, but it's not something that's brand new and it's something that parents, teenagers, children have to be aware of.
Yes, unfortunately, these kind of scams go on all of the time. They don't target just teenagers, they target adults and anyone else who is using social media. But of course, in this particular case, it's particularly nasty because they're targeting teenagers who are maybe a bit more vulnerable.
Social media is where the majority of this is taking place, the likes of Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. And it's usually from people that the victim doesn't know. It might start with an innocent friend request from a random person that they accept, and then all of a sudden it just leads on from there.
Yeah, the social media is just, all pervasive in our society today. It's how we communicate, socialise, entertain ourselves and so on. And so that's the place where unscrupulous people will go to try and take advantage of people and to make money out of them. And in this case, what happens is the scammers come in and they trick a young person into thinking they're communicating with somebody that they might be attracted to or interested in being in a relationship with or being intimate with. And pretty soon into that exchange, they ask for an intimate image. If the young person shares the intimate image, it's not that unusual because we know from our research that over 50% of teenagers have sent or do send intimate images. So the behavior in itself is not that unusual. What's happening here is that these scammers are capitalizing in on the vulnerability that goes with sharing an intimate image of yourself. As soon as the person shares the image, then the blackmail starts.
I suppose it's a difficult situation, particularly for parents as well, because while we can give the advice to always check what your child or your teenager is doing online, when it involves intimate images like this, the person themselves are going to be reluctant to maybe hand their phone over or tell their parents exactly what they're doing online when it involves those sort of images. So it's hard for parents to monitor.
It goes to the heart of that relationship between a parent and their teenage daughter or son in this case. And, the level to which they're able to talk about these things will be really challenged by this, So really, I suppose, before an incident like this ever happens, it's really good to have open conversations with the younger people in your home, what might happen online, how to watch out for it, and the most important thing is to reassure them from day one that if anything like this happens online, it is not the end of the world. You will not think less of them. We will sort this out together. And that kind of reassurance is really important. At the moment, right now, when it happens to the young person, they feel like their world is over, as they know it. But in 5 or 10 years' time, that teenager will be a different person, and their life will move on, and things will get better. So it's really important to reassure them about all of that. Now, there's a bigger piece there about, in relation to sex education and how we talk to our young people about what's appropriate and safe for them and what choices to make around sharing of intimate images and so on. And that's a bigger educational piece that really needs to be addressed with our young people.
It does, definitely. Do you think we're breaking down the walls, though, in terms of that, particularly in schools, the likes of sex education, but also with younger people speaking to their peers, their colleagues, their parents, whatever it might be? The, I suppose, stigmatisation of that is definitely breaking down a little bit.
Yeah, I think, you know, as we kind of continue on this journey of technology being part of our lives, so much as it is now today, we're understanding that some of the behaviours and some of the desires and some of the patterns that we live our lives according to are making their way online. And with that comes new opportunities and new challenges. Young people, teenagers, have always sought to be intimate with other you know, people they're attracted to. And we know from our research that the majority of sexting behaviour goes on between romantic partners, or at least somebody that you want to be a romantic partner with, and rather than strangers. This kind of scam is exceptional, even though it's very disturbing. But we do need to have more open conversations about how to be online in this way, and if it's a, you know, to be aware of when you make a decision and you have a thought, that an action comes after, there are consequences, and to be able to prepare and plan for those, and to be able to make informed choices. You know, the safest thing is not to engage in any way electronically with anyone else who might possibly share your photograph or be cruel to you after you share that photograph in some way. But the research is telling us that young people are doing this, so I would feel it's probably good to prepare them to do it in a safer way.
And finally, Professor O'Higgins-Norman, it is worth pointing out as well that this is now an offence. It's illegal under a new act that was passed in terms of revenge porn. So if anybody shares these images that you have sent to somebody in confidence, that's against the law. They're breaking the law.
Yep, last February, the government introduced COCO's law, which is now in place, and it is against the law to harass somebody or bully someone or exploit somebody based on the sharing of intimate images online or in social media. The law is very new. Hopefully it will result in a change in behaviour long term, but at the moment you know, we're still looking to see what the effects of that law will be. But it's really, really important to keep open lines of communication with young people, talk to them about this stuff, and get them ready to deal with what might come up online. And if anyone experiences themselves being blackmailed in any way about an image, it is all nearly 99% of the time a scam, and they should not delete it. They should keep the information, keep the images, keep the exchanges, and bring them to the guards.
Well, Professor James O'Higgins-Norman, UNESCO Chair on Tackling Bullying in Schools and Cyberspace and Director of the National Anti-Bullying Centre at DCU, specialising in online safety, with that advice as parents and teenagers are being warned about an online scam involving intimate images. Professor O'Higgins-Norman, many thanks for joining us on the programme this morning, and good morning.
Have a great day.
You too. Okay, let's go to Ciara then in Studio 2.
A new ESRI report suggests that Ireland is no country for disabled people who want to work. Joining me this morning is the director of the National Disability Authority, Dr. Aideen Hartney. Good morning, Dr. Hartney.
Good morning, Ciara.
It's quite a comprehensive publication. Yourselves at the NDA commissioned the ESRI to undertake. So the context of the research, it begins with the government's National Disability Strategy Implementation Plan. This was published in 2013. Then in 2015, the Comprehensive Employment Strategy for People with Disabilities was also published. And that its objective was to support people with disabilities in accessing the labour market. But with the findings of yesterday's report and what the research suggests, did these strategies essentially fail?
Well, Ciara, you're absolutely right that we have some very powerful strategies for improving outcomes for people with disabilities in Ireland. Indeed, we're often recognised internationally as having quite a rich policy system in this regard. But yes, the report that was published yesterday by the ESRI does show that the figures tell a different story. And we also, at the same time yesterday, launched a report we commissioned from the OECD, and that kind of cemented those findings, where probably only about one in three people with a disability are in employment. and or maybe one in 10 are on a disability payment. And these are some of the highest figures in the EU and the OECD jurisdictions. And what we know from our own research in the National Disability Authority is that about at least a third of those on disability payments would like to work and be interested in work if the situations were right. Now, I think there's a lot of recommendations and actions in the various strategies you've spoken about. And the key really is to get all the government departments and public bodies working together to deliver on those strategies. And we were delighted to be able to publish those reports yesterday because they do show a very clear mandate for the action.
Yeah, among the EU countries, Dr. Hartney, Ireland had the fourth lowest employment rate among people with disabilities of working age. That was in 2018. And again, I think people may be surprised by this number. 11% and 11.5% of the population experiences at least one disability. That's approximately 500,000 people in this country.
It is indeed, and that's the working age population, Ciara. There'd be about 643,000 all told. So yes, it is a significant portion of the population, and actually that's really an opportunity. One of the things that both the ESRI and the OECD report speak to is a need for a mix of approaches. It's not just about what government departments and public bodies can do. It's also about what employers themselves can do. And I think the figures that you're quoting there show employers that there is this huge market there with labour skills and abilities that they can tap into, particularly now at a time when we're hearing that so many employers are finding it difficult to recruit people to fill their vacancies.
You know, the old saying, you know, you don't know a person until you walk in their own shoes. And in relation to everyday difficulties, 30% of those that reported having a disability in 2016 indicated they had difficulty undertaking work or study. That was followed by difficulty undertaking other activities at 30.6%, and difficulty even going outside, 18.7%. Over a third, obviously, had more than one disability, it mentions here. And it is so true. It's not until these issues are brought right in front of your eyes and highlighted to such a degree that you actually begin to comprehend what a struggle it is for people living with disabilities.
Yes, that's right, Ciara. But I think what those figures again show is it's not that the issue lies with the person themselves. It's that our society and our systems are not configured to accommodate all the needs of people with disabilities. And it's about putting some accommodations or practical solutions in place that can help people who have difficulties in going outside or perhaps difficulties walking. What can be done to ensure that they can participate in society and participate in work? And some of that might be about making adjustments to the physical environment. Some of it might be just about configuring work a little bit more flexibly. And I think we'll all be very familiar with our experiences over the last 18 months where so much of the world moved to remote working and moved to online working. These are opportunities that can be looked at for some people with disabilities. It kind of opens up opportunities that would previously have been closed. But really it is about everybody just looking at a situation flexibly and seeing what can be done to break down the barriers for people with disabilities in experiencing employment.
So would that give you confidence, obviously, with what's happened over the past 18 months, that something can come out of that?
I think there's a clear opportunity, and I hope that people would be ready and standing by to take up that opportunity. One of the stark findings from the ESRI report, though, that we would particularly take notice of, and it echoes very much what the National Disability Authority would have found over the last number of years, people with disabilities did not recover from the last financial crisis to the same extent as the rest of the population. So the crisis that hit in 2008, and there were many, many people made redundant or found it difficult to find work, while the rest of us may have had some luck and opportunity in recovering from that, it did not happen to the same extent for people with disabilities. And I think it is crucially important that we make sure that they are not left behind in this particular recovery period as well.
Just to note there, Dr. Hartney, in 2019, the at-risk of poverty rate for people without disabilities of working age was 11%. It was 23% for people with disabilities. This is a very comprehensive report, as I've said, 143 pages. And just a note before you go, while overall education levels have increased, the education gap between people with and without disabilities remains. What hope or what I guess expansion could be made from this report in terms of the education gap?
Well, I suppose the good news on the education gap is that it is closing, albeit a little slowly. So we are catching up and improving there. And that's about some of the supports that are being provided in our schools and in our colleges to help people with disabilities participate in education and get the skills and the qualifications that are so necessary to them for employment. I think one of the key things now is to ensure that the transition point between education and employment is well managed. And that requires coordination between a range of agencies and public bodies and I think a willingness to engage in that coordination and to manage it in an efficient way will be hugely helpful in further closing the employment gap.
Well, Dr. Aideen Hartney, Director of the National Disability Authority, thank you for joining me this morning.
Thank you very much, Ciara.
Kildare Today.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
All right, local issues now, and joining me on the line is independent councillor on the Kildare Newbridge Municipal District, Councillor Fiona McLaughlin Healy. Good morning, Fiona.
Good morning, Owen. How are you?
I'm not too bad. Motions sure. That you brought forward to the recent meeting then, and we'll start off with the bus shelter, or the bus route, I should say, in between Cara and Naas. You also wanted a ballpark timeline for its introduction. What response did you get there?
So I can give you a very quick response on that. So November 2019, residents signed a petition for me in Cara. Hundreds of residents signed a petition because they can't get in or out without using their cars. And if we're talking about livable, sustainable community zone, we need public transport, we need cycle lanes. The cycle lanes is a little bit more complicated because it requires land acquisition, so we need the bus transport. But Local Link were into us in February 2020 and had acknowledged the petition, and I was just looking for an update on that. It's at the planning stages and I'm hopeful that there's going to be a positive announcement on that soon.
Okay, good news then between Cara and Naas. Sticking with public transport and the issue of a bus shelter at Kilcullen, the legal transfer of the land for the bus shelter, what's this about?
Yeah, so look, there's a badly needed bus shelter in Kilcullen outside Cross and Passion School. It has been turned down numerous occasions by the NTA because there isn't enough space there. I spoke with Sister Moira of the Sisters, the Cross and Passion Sisters, in November 2019, and she agreed at that time in principle with the council to transfer land very kindly and generously to the community. On foot of that, the NTA agreed to provide funding and have provided the funding. So as you can imagine, I'm anxious to make sure that all the legalities and all of that goes through so that we can access and draw down the funding. And basically what they're waiting on, as I understand it, is for the charities regulator to actually give the go-ahead for the land being used for a different purpose. So hopefully, again, we'll have good news on that shortly.
This motion as well, Fiona, I know you've been on top of this for quite a while, calling on the council to respond to the dire need, as you put it, for outdoor amenities and leisure facilities around Newbridge and also around its hinterlands.
This is something that we really, really, really have to grapple with in Newbridge. You know the amount of building that's going on. There's hundreds of new houses being built, which is fantastic if you have the infrastructure to take it. We already know as it exists, there's a shortage of places for pitches for soccer and football clubs. But there are other needs, like we have been given the offer of a free national standard BMX park for the district that I have not been able to find a location for as of yet. We know that the volleyball club, which is doing brilliantly well in Newbridge, really desperately needs a place. And we also know, and this is an issue that, you know, really has to be addressed as well, the Curra Plains, you know, we know that there is scrambling going on and doing serious damage on the Curra Plains. And I really don't want to, be negative about people who are into scrambling and motocross racing and all the rest. We just don't want it on the Curra. But we need to start providing places for people to be able to do these activities healthy and in a way that isn't doing damage. So we really need to identify a location for motocross racing as well in the area. And I was down in Kenmare over the summer, and I was dropping off the kids to a water activity, and I went across the road, and there was just not a huge piece of land, but at the bottom there was a playground and crazy golf, And as I walked further up, there was archery and what you call it, the paintballing. And there was a trail for bikes, for motocross bikes. And I just thought, you know, this is the type of thing that we need. This is what we need to be looking at. And I know I had a motion earlier in the year with the council, and they are looking at lands that are zoned and not owned by the council in order to look at what we might need to buy to actually deliver these facilities. But we absolutely need them. And it's not just a social and nice argument, you know, to have nice things. There's an economic argument for providing leisure facilities and amenities for young people, because if we don't provide healthy options for them, they will turn to unhealthy options. So there is a social and an economic argument when you're talking about lowering the levels of crime and addiction and all of the rest.
Absolutely. But before I let you go, Fiona, you touched on it there, the state of the Curragh over the weekend. There was pictures circulating online and listeners got in touch with us as well. I mean, this is from cars, scramblers, etc. that are, you know, driving around the Curragh Plains, and they left the place in an awful state.
It's not just cars and scramblers, you see, and I know that Ken sort of wanted to finish up. We got a good airing on the issue around the sheep, but sheep are being herded on the Curragh, and at night time, and you know, there's big 4x4s actually herding sheep, which is not allowed. It is not a right that comes along with having the sheep on the Curragh. And again, there's issues around that whole vigilance and oversight of the overgrazing on the Curragh, how the sheep are branded, the fact that sheep can be moved on and off the Curragh before checks are done, all of that type of thing. But I absolutely agree, the issue of the scrambling and the damage being done by vehicles is huge on the Curragh. And as I said, you know, we have to provide healthy options for the people that are using it as a leisure facility. We have to find a place for them to go, as we did for skateboarders who were using very dangerous places and railings around the town before we provided the skate park. It is a good thing when the facilities are available. But the Curragh is not appropriate, and there's huge damage being done on the Curragh. So again, okay, we really need to address that issue. But it's both the scramblers and the herding of sheep that is causing that damage, Owen.
All right. Independent councillor on the Kildare Newbridge Municipal District, Fiona McLaughlin Healy. Thanks for joining us on the programme this morning, Fiona. Just before we go to Kira, a text that came in just to correct that Teresa and Annie, who will be in the family room of Cara Church today, doing a collection for St. Bridget's Hospice in the Curragh. Their coffee morning won't go ahead as normal this year. All donations gratefully accepted. They'll be there between 10 and 12 this morning, not between 10 and 2 as was originally stated. So between 10 and 12, if you want to make a donation, call down to Cara Church there. All right, Kira.
On Monday, the automatic contact tracing of close contacts in creches and primary schools will discontinue. So that means those without symptoms within those age groups will no longer have to restrict their movement, and at home, that is, for up to 10 days until they receive a negative test. Joining me now is Professor Kingston Mills, Professor of Experimental Immunology at the School of Biochemistry and Immunology at Trinity College. Good morning, Kingston.
Good morning.
Professor Mills, many parents are puzzled by this. Vaccination means one's chance of getting severely ill from the virus substantially decreases. But these creche and primary age school groups, they're not included in the vaccination programme currently. So why eliminate these age groups from the contact tracing?
Yes, it is a bit surprising. I mean, the vaccines which are now being given to 12-year-olds and graders really are working very effectively. And what's been happening in the last few weeks is that the percentage of cases in the under-12s is increasing. Now accounts for over 20%. The 5 to 12-year-old, and with the, if you include the under-5s, you know, you've got nearly 30% of all the cases are in under-12s. So it means that a lot of transmission must be occurring in that age group. At least it's occurring because they're not immune, and whereas most of the other age groups are, or most people in the other age groups are immune through the vaccines. So it means that the younger age group are now the dominant group that are getting infected, and whether they're getting infected in schools or home, I couldn't tell you, but certainly if you reduce the testing of contacts, well, then you're going to reduce the possibility of catching people that might be infected.
parents of vulnerable children in particular within those age groups are going to be very worried by this, and we've seen the dialogue that's been happening on Twitter and social media platforms in particular over the past few days in terms of this news has really worried them. They fought so hard, Professor Mills, to get their kids back into the classrooms, and now they're probably going to feel like they have to pull them out again.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely essential that our children are back in education, not only primary, secondary, but also third level. It's essential. So, but this has to be done safely as well. And you don't want to put the, you know, the health of other young children or teachers at risk. So I think it has to be done in a way that minimizes the possibility that people get affected. The risks of severe disease in under 12s is very low compared with adults or older people. But there are a small proportion of children, even under the age of 12, that can get prolonged symptoms that can persist for a month or even 2 months with COVID-19. So it's not a trivial disease in some children, and that there are minorities that can get, you know, these more prolonged symptoms. So, really you don't want children to get this disease no more than you want an adult to get it. So whatever measures we can put in place, that includes testing. The problem has been in the last few weeks, the numbers of testing has gone through the roof. So they're testing a huge number of people every day. And the system is under a huge pressure because of the opening of the schools largely, and the numbers of children that are contacts with known cases that have to be traced and tested. So that's putting a lot of pressure on the system. So, you know, that may be one of the reasons that they've decided to go this measure. And the feeling is, I think, that transmission is very low amongst very young children. So it's maybe not worth the effort to test all the contacts.
Professor Mills, I think people hear from yourself and peers, obviously experts in immunology over the past 18 months, and hear the exact advice and, I guess, opinions that you give on the situation. But making it personal, and I think a lot of parents, if they had the chance to speak to yourself or your peers, they would probably ask, if you had children who were creche or primary school age, how would you feel about them going back into the classroom on Monday when the changes are made?
Well, I'm older than that group, so I don't have my children who are grown up now, so I can't...
Hypothetically,
I have lots of friends who have children, younger friends who have children in that situation, and they are concerned, it has to be said. And I've also got friends who have children that are in school, and then they have to take the children out of school because they're contacts. And that, of course, means that the parents who are working have to find alternative arrangements to look after their children. And I know lots of colleagues that's putting them under severe pressure because, you know, they're back at work, back physically at work now. And if they're working at home, it means they're having to mind the children as well as try and do their work. So it's putting parents of young children under tremendous pressure when children are sent home from school. So there's sort of a balancing act here between unnecessary sending of children home and causing lots of grief for the parents, and at the same time making sure that you minimise the possibility of transmission if there genuinely is, you know, contacts with cases. So it is a balancing act, and there's a lot of things that have to be taken into consideration. So it's not a simple solution, say, just test everybody and isolate them that are contacts. And then you'll have every school in the country closed. That's what will happen.
And you see, I think that's the difficulty for many parents, because they are finding it difficult themselves because they're going through these questions in their own head. Am I making the right decision or am I not? As you said, there's a balance to be struck, and that is the hard position parents are in. Finally, Professor Mills, just to touch on it, the Irish National Teachers Organisation, the INTO, they warned that it's too early to drop the contact tracing in primary schools, and they're predicting it could lead to closures by Halloween. What's your opinion on that?
I think, as you know, it's inevitable there's going to be more cases, especially if you don't test the contacts. I mean, this is assuming there is significant transmission, and that's the evidence of that's still, you know, not that clear. But, I mean, transmission between children. There's no doubt there's transmission from adults to children, and there's also transmission from children to adults. I mean, you know, that's one of the risks that hasn't been spoken about. You know, children getting infected in school and going home to parents or grandparents that are older, vulnerable because they're immunosuppressed for whatever reason, or they haven't been vaccinated, or they've waning immunity. So that's a big risk as well. I mean, the bottom line on all of this is that, you know, what's going to happen in a few months, or probably, you know, towards the end of October, the EMA, the European Medicines Agency, is very likely to approve vaccines for the under-12s. And then the authorities here have to make that difficult decision, are they going to vaccinate that age group? I mean, the clinical trials that have come out of the States have shown the vaccines are highly effective in that age group, more effective, in fact, than in the older groups.
Okay.
So it will be the solution in the long term.
Well, Professor Kingston Mills, Professor of Experimental Immunology at Trinity College Dublin, thank you again for your time.
Okay, just to wrap up then with some of the messages that have come in over the last hour or so. No, cauliflower isn't the same as the rest. It tastes very different. It's beautiful. Have to agree with you there. I wasn't a big fan of cauliflower when I was younger. Still not a fan of cauliflower and cheese, I have to say, although a lot of people do like that. But I can tolerate cauliflower now. Still can't get the hang of Brussels sprouts whatsoever. And this is all to do with a new survey that has come out to try and explain the reason why children don't like the likes of Brussels sprouts or broccoli or cabbage when they're younger. Please wish Corey Corkish in Kilmeague a very happy 17th birthday. Love from Dad, Mam, Zachary, Ross and Lily. Hopefully have a great day, Corey, out there in Kilmeague. To correct Fiona's record, the damage last weekend was done by a car doing donuts. And indeed, you sent in a picture there of Donnelly's Hollow over the last day or so. And yeah, you can tell that those are cars is just basically doing rings around the place, and no time for that whatsoever. Hi Owen, if Fiona is still listening, there are loads of disused quarries around the Curragh which would be ideal for scrambling. Maybe they could look at renting or purchasing one of these. I know work is going on behind the scenes about that. A couple of messages coming in as well, just wondering if we're doing the interview with a potential candidate for the Kildare GAA job this morning. I can tell you myself and Clem Ryan, all of yesterday and even the day before yesterday, we've been working quite hard behind the scenes trying to get in contact with those three potential candidates for the Kildare senior football job, and in the next hour we'll have a comprehensive roundup of what's been happening behind the scenes over the last while. So stay tuned, and we'll bring that to you very shortly.